You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter. It ain't sunny out there, though. It's, no, it's raining right now.
Well, I don't know. Maybe where you are, I don't see any rain happening at this moment here in Dixon as I look out the window at my gloomy backyard. Gloomy. It's very pretty, but gloomy. I'll have to tell you, yesterday evening as I walked down the long driveway, of course, the turkeys are doing their every evening thing of running along my 900-foot driveway and flying up to land in my London plane tree where they roost for the night. Sounds kind of cute, but it's kind of messy. And then there's a few of them lined up on a branch looking for all the world like turkey vultures. Now I know where the name turkey vultures comes from. And curled up over on my potting bench is the fox, just gazing at them, watching me walk by, all of them getting ready for the incoming storm. Now, this storm was touted pretty heavily by meteorologists up in the Pacific Northwest and even in the northwestern parts of California. And I noticed the Sacramento weather folks were kind of jumping on that bandwagon of, hey, a big storm is coming our way. But if you looked at the trajectory, it is doing exactly as expected. They've had 3 inches plus rain in Brookings, Oregon, and something like that in Crescent City, Eureka area, and then less and less and less rainfall as you come further south. And we have received a grand total in the last 24 hours of 0.23 inches of rain in Davis.
That's less than a quarter of an inch.
Correct. Less than a quarter of an inch. In Vacaville, a little bit higher at 0.4 inches. So we're enjoying this. Great for the plants, fantastic weather for scattering seed of wildflowers and grasses and things like that, but doesn't look like we're going to get a significant amount out of this. And by the time this show, which Lois and I are recording on November 5, 2025, by the time it airs November 6, 2025, it'll be out of here and we might have had an inch of rain total, if that much, by the time it's all over. We're not getting much out of this one. And then we're going into sunny weather for the rest of the week. In fact, it's going to be spectacularly beautiful here. Temperature today is only going to be 61 degrees, today being Wednesday, November 5th. 52 degrees tonight, 67 degrees on Thursday. Decreasing clouds Thursday night, 52. We're still staying above 50 most nights. We've been in the 40s a few times, and that is having some impact on some plants and causing some conversations at my nursery. Why are my hibiscus leaves yellowing? Thursday night will be 52. Friday will be 69 and mostly sunny. Friday night will be 51 and mostly clear. Saturday, all right, garden center professionals everywhere in the Sacramento Valley. Saturday is going to be 69 degrees and mostly sunny. I hope you're fully staffed. Saturday night will be 49 degrees and partly cloudy. Sunday, mostly sunny with a high near 73. Sunday night, 51. Monday, 73. Monday night, 52, mostly cloudy. Veterans Day, Tuesday, holiday for many people, mostly sunny with a high near 71. Looking at the forecast for next week, we do see, now pause while I reopen it, rain coming in Wednesday and Thursday of next week. And this looks pretty firm. And it looks like more rain, like maybe an inch to an inch and a quarter of rain over the two-day period a week out. These storms are out there. They're coming towards us. Typical La Nina pattern so far where they're just shifting north and going over us and they're getting rain up in Redding and over in the Shasta and in the Coast Range and we're not getting it. This next one looks a little more promising for the Sacramento Valley. If you've just moved here, we generally get about 18 to 20 inches of rainfall a year. It usually starts late October, and the last rain is generally early April. Yes, we have rain in late April and May, but it usually doesn't amount to much. In that time, in that November to April period, we typically get a dozen to 15 storms, each of them carrying 1 inch to 2 inches. That's the pattern every 7 to 10 days in a normal rainfall year. We have a lot of years that are not normal. We have years where we go weeks without rainfall and years where we have atmospheric rivers that slam right into us and give us 2, 3, 4 inches of rain all at once. But the usual pattern is every week or so about 1 inch to 2 inches of rain. But right now, so far, we've been a little bit above average. We got another storm coming in next week. So we're kind of on track for, let's cross our fingers, maybe a normal rainfall year. Wouldn't that be amazing? KDRT is community radio. That's public radio. We rely on contributions from listeners like you to fund our operating costs. So if you like what you hear, if you like the Davis Garden Show, all the other great programming here at KDRT, head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button.
So we talk a lot about Bohart Museum of Entomology. It's part of the University of California at Davis. And Don just discovered something this morning. I always love it when Don discovers something in some place that he's known for years.
Yeah.
Turns out that if you go to the following URL, and let me read that carefully, Bohart, that's B-O-H-A-R-T, bohart.ucdavis.edu/insect-info-sheets. And what you'll come up with is a list of a lot of insects info sheets at the Bohart Museum.
Well, and these are about the insects that we don't, on a gardening show, deal with that much. These are indoor pests, springtails, ticks, fleas, mites, earthworms. That's an interesting one. Scorpions. I grew up with a lot of those. Kissing bugs, Jerusalem cricket, cockroaches. There was a question a long time ago about cockroaches, and they have an article not just about the American cockroach, but exotic roaches of California. Praying mantis, oriental cockroach, widow spiders, and so forth. Lots of information about the kinds of pests, if you want to call them that, insects, arachnids, and others that you might encounter that we don't come across that commonly in talking about garden things, because these are mostly not garden pests. And I scrolled down here, and one of my absolute favorite miscellaneous info sheets is urban myths. 18 urban myths. Number one, butterflies and moths can't fly if you rub the scales off their wings. Nope, not true. They can fly. Number four, brown recluse spiders are common in California, biting many people. No, brown recluse spiders are not found anywhere near California. Ultrasonic devices help keep pests out of your kitchen. False. Few insects can hear, certainly not cockroaches. Mosquitoes transmit HIV. They cannot transmit HIV. Earwigs will crawl into your ear and lay eggs in your brain. They sometimes do crawl into ears by accident, but they do not lay eggs. Fascinating little urban myths here, and that's a good one that kids might enjoy. So head on over and read the urban myths one. But for those of you with questions about things like cockroaches and spiders and some of the other things that we don't typically come across in the, you know, when you send us questions, you're not usually asking us a lot about those. You'll find some really interesting stuff. Indian meal moth, the moth that gets in your pantry, so forth. And then things like monarch butterfly, pipe vine, swallowtail. Great articles. My compliments to the folks at Bohart once again for some really useful public education material at Bohart, B-O-H-A-R-T, .ucdavis.edu.
So the next item up is frost protection in the garden. We are not saying it's going to freeze now, but it's nice to have figured out what you plan to do. So tell us about frost protection in the garden.
Well, first of all, our first frost, almost every year I've been here, has been right around Thanksgiving.
So it's in November, and this is November.
3 weeks away. So we drop rapidly in temperature, and cloudy days, you're not going to get frost. Stormy periods, you're not going to get frost. It's when those storms scoot out of here, and it all clears up, and it's open to the sky, and the nights, the temperatures drop rapidly. And if at sunset, it's in the 40s, and it's a clear sky, there's a very high likelihood that you will see frost on surfaces that night. Whether that's a thing to be concerned about, probably not. It just means that that surface got cold. But that does mean we're getting to the point where you could get plant injury on some types of plants. And this is why at the beginning of November at our garden center, and hopefully out in your yard, you're walking around going, there's a jade plant that's out in the open. Jade plants are a little frost tender here. Time to move that jade plant in its container closer to the building. all that we do at our garden center, we have lots of succulents, lots of cactus, lots of things like that, a whole big area that's a big category for us. Some of them, I'll start with the succulents, jade plants, some of the aloes, but especially aloe vera, so that's why I always mention that one, some of the euphorbias, a few of the other house succulents, will be cosmetically damaged by cold weather. They'll survive very likely. They will probably come back, but there'll be so much injury to the leaves and the top that they'll look really bad. And if it happens again and again, it can get to the point where they'll be injured and rot and the plant will die. So we bring them closer to the building to avoid the frost itself and also to get them out of the rain, because they're succulents. And the combination of cold and wet is the biggest issue. And this is true for most tropical to subtropical plants as well. They can tolerate surprisingly cold temperatures in many cases, but if they get injured by frost and then it's wet, and it's usually warmer when it's wet here, their rot will set in and you'll probably lose the plant. So all we do, they're on the east side of our building, we pull them up against the building, and the building itself creates a rain shadow, so it keeps those plants relatively dry, and it provides 2 to 4 degrees of protection. And that's all we need in our area. Henry in Michigan, different issue. But in our area, we only need a few degrees of protection. And every one of the frost protection measures that you're going to read about or hear about provides, each of them provides a couple degrees protection. So you can simply move them closer to the building. I have a customer who's bound and determined to get his Emerald Towers basil plant through the winter. That's his goal. So I said, all right, if you have an east or a south facing wall with an overhang, sometime around now, pull it closer to the wall, where they're preferably east or south facing, because you get morning sun with an east facing wall, and south facing, not just morning sun, you get sun for much, even much more of the day. Those are the warm sides of your house. Those are the important microclimates. The overhang blocks the loss of heat to the sky, so it traps the warmer air around the plant. So some kind of an overhang, rain shadow can be very helpful for not just succulent plants, but also subtropical or tropical plants. And this is the time right now, early November is the time, I always use Halloween as my marker, but early November is the time to start moving those plants closer in so they'll be under the overhang. There are some plants that are just very unlikely to make it through anyway, but if you want to give it a try, by ones I'm specifically referring to here that have become really popular in the last few years, tropical hibiscus, Hibiscus rosa-sinensis, they're selling like crazy, not just at garden centers, but hardware stores, and people are buying them thinking they're hardy because they're just out there, you know, they're selling them, they must be hardy, right? No, they're not hardy here, but up against the wall, under an overhang on an east or south side, sometimes they make it through. And the other is these very popular vines, the mandevillas, mandevilla is spelled mandevilla, which are probably technically diplodenias. They are beautiful pink, red, bicolor flowers, tubular flowers, trumpet-shaped flowers. Vigorous vine, grows rapidly in the summertime, and hardy to about 32 degrees. And we get below 32 degrees here every winter. Just for the record, those of you new to Davis, yes, we do get frost. Yes, we do get below 32 degrees here. We're not zone 10, we're zone 9. So I have seen these, the mandevillas, get through the winter when they're in a patio, for example, with an overhang, or a place where the plant itself is under an overhang. Even if the plant is cascading out into more sun or more exposure, the plant is back in more protection. I've seen them occasionally get through the winter. I just wish nurseries and hardware stores would stop selling them as if they're hardy. That's what frustrates me. They're not. They're not reliably hardy here, but they're about as hardy as a tropical hibiscus. Yeah, we all know someone that's gotten one through the winter, but it isn't going to be reliable or consistent. So those are two in particular, and there's other tropical plants in that same category. Move them under the overhang, east or south exposure if you possibly can, because that gives you more sunlight early in the day, especially the east exposure, and hope for the best.
And if you have something outside that you're planning to bring in, whether that's a house plant that has to come in for the winter, or if you want to try that tropical hibiscus, I had one sitting right outside my sliding glass door on the south side of the house. So for winter, I just rolled that thing right inside the same sliding door. It went 6 feet north and it was fine.
Yeah.
But if you do that, be sure that you dunk the whole thing in water and make sure you don't bring ants into your house. You would be really, really unhappy if you brought a pot full of ants into your house.
Yeah, we talked about that a week or so ago, but this is the main thing. Hibiscus get aphids, and so check them carefully for aphids. And usually there's not a lot of them on there, but it doesn't take very many aphids coming in to warmer temperatures to multiply very rapidly. So a really vigorous rinse is probably all you need to do, but just check the undersides of the leaves before it comes indoors. Hibiscus in particular, that's a problem.
Anyway, so if there is frost going to happen, and you can't move the plant because it's in the ground instead of in a pot, what do you do to protect it?
First of all, don't worry about most things. If we're selling a plant, if garden centers or hardware stores are selling a plant, the vast majority of them are not tender here. The questions we get are almost always about citrus.
You mean about a perennial plant, not an annual plant? Annual plants are going to die anyway.
Yeah, they're done. Don't worry about them. And well, let's go back to that one. Annual plants like marigolds and impatiens and things like that. Yeah, they're going to die with frost, and that's what they're supposed to do. You're supposed to plant pansies and snapdragons, violas, cyclamen, things like that, which are perfectly tolerant down into the 20s. So that's generally not. We just know that. Hopefully, we know that there are seasonal cycles to what we sell and call annuals. But it's the woody plants that are the biggest concern. Yeah. And 99% of the questions are about citrus. Do I need to cover my citrus? A newly planted citrus tree, if we get into the mid-20s, will be injured. I'm speaking not just from training, but direct experience here. And it doesn't even matter that much what it is at first. In the long run, mandarins, for example, are very cold hardy. My mandarins have gone down below 20 degrees and the plants were unharmed. Navel oranges, grapefruit, things like that can go into the mid-20s, upper 20s with no problem. The tender citrus that you might be concerned about overall, if we're having a real cold snap, not just a frost, but a real cold freeze, would be the lemons and the limes and the citron, for that matter, the Buddha's hand citron. Those are the ones that are the most tender and could be pretty severely injured, let's say 26, 27, 28 degrees, which does happen here, but not every year. More of a problem for those of us out in the country. This is a case where in town makes a big difference versus out in the open. I'm having a back and forth with someone in Winters. Y'all know the area, you know where Winters is. It's out in the country, basically. It's a city, but it's out in the country. And she wants to plant 18 citrus trees. And I was like, yeah, that's all fine. This is not the perfect time to plant them. Oh, I thought fall was a great time to plant trees. No, fall is a good time to plant, but citrus are technically subtropical, so they go best in late spring, early summer. It's fine to plant them in the fall. I've got a couple more that are going in the ground. Just be aware that the most tender part of a citrus is the green wood, the new growth that occurred this summer. And last year, well, we're still in the year, but January 2025, we got to 23 degrees on our farm for just a few hours, one night in late January. And I had six of the young mandarins in my orchard that were relatively young and put on a fair bit of soft green tissue growth, and it was all badly damaged. In fact, they were badly damaged enough that I replaced a couple of them, even though they're mandarins, which in the long run will be perfectly hardy. So young citrus plants that are still mostly green wood, and this goes for anything else in the subtropical category, perhaps consider protecting it. Be aware of the possibility of low temperatures injuring it and have a plan. The plan is have some frost blanket on hand. Just drape it over the plant if we're getting unusually cold. A normal frost is not an issue. It's one of these 2 or 3 day events where it's a real cold air mass that's moved in. Temperatures in the low to mid 20s can do some injury to young citrus. The same plant 2 years later will be fine because it's mostly semi-hardwood to hardwood. So the injury is the green, more tender wood. And that goes for bougainvilleas, which people like to plant here. Established bougainvilleas are fine. The first year, first 2 years, you may get significant frost damage on them if we get just an unusually cold spell. And we do still get those cold spells. I keep having to have conversations with people who think we don't get frost here anymore, or we don't get freezing weather here anymore. We get 10 to 20 visible frosts every winter, sometimes more, 25 or 30 if you're out in the country. We get below 32 reliably every winter here in the Sacramento Valley. We typically get down to 29, 30 degrees a couple of times. Sometimes we get below that. Those are the concerns, is the nights where we've gotten below that. It's going to be completely clear and still on a night like that. Usually the day after north wind has come in, so it's low humidity, it's dry, the sky is open, nothing to trap the heat, and it gets unusually cold and we'll get some injury. And again, citrus are the biggest concern. Most commonly, when we get that cold injury on that tender growth, the plant will resprout in the spring. What usually happens, though, is it also comes up from below the graft union in the spring. So these are the problem trees that I see 5 years later. when half the tree is rootstock. That's why that happened, is someone was not aware as it resprouted that a bunch of what came back up was from below the graft. So monitor that in any event, but especially if we've had an unusually cold spell sometime December, January. There are at least five different articles about frost and freeze on my website. One of the most common topics I've written on for the Davis Enterprise. So just head on over to redwoodbarn.com. Go to that little Google search box that searches just the website itself. You'll find all kinds of articles about frost protection, what to be concerned about, steps you can take, and what plants are of particular concern.
Okay, here we go. Hi, it's Henry from Michigan again. A while back, I asked you questions regarding my Meyer lemon tree.
Yeah.
I did have good success with that tree, but I had to give it up because we moved into a condo with limited space. We do have a sunroom, which is great, but unfortunately, in the winter, we need to close the doors to it because it gets kind of cold. It is heated, but the temperature in the winter can get as low as 50 degrees, never lower than that. I'm considering getting some houseplants, and I was wondering about which houseplants to get that would be okay in this environment. In the winter, if the sun's out, the room will warm up to 79 degrees.
Sure.
But here in Michigan, because of Lake Michigan, it tends to be cloudy all the time. A day with sun is rare, but okay. Much appreciated. The room gets good lighting, but I'm just concerned about how cold it may be at night. Any suggestions for which houseplants would do well up here in the frozen North Country?
Frozen North Country. 50 degrees is a rather important threshold temperature, actually. Most truly tropical plants, let's say golden pothos or the well-known philodendrons like that, come from places where it rarely gets below 60, 65. I mean, pothos itself is an example of one that's from a native to an island near Tahiti. And the temperature there is like 65 to 85 year round. Sounds pretty nice, huh? Anything below 55 is beginning to affect the plant. Anything below 50 will adversely affect it. But as long as you know it doesn't drop below 50, you're probably fine with most of the tropical plants. You can expect if you have long periods with lack of light, like really cloudy days and low temperatures in that room, that they will perhaps start to yellow and shed some of the older leaves. Be careful not to water too often when you're in that situation. When it's below optimal temperature conditions and lower light, it's pretty easy to rot a plant by watering it too frequently. So let things go a little bit drier. But most of the aroids, A-R-O-I-D, aroids, will probably work out for you as long as you don't get below 50 very often or at all would be preferable. Aroid refers to everything in the family Araceae, golden pothos, aglaonema, philodendrons, your very common houseplants. Philodendrons and all of their ilk are probably going to be okay for you as long as it doesn't get substantially below 50. But there's a lot of things we grow as houseplants that are not true tropicals. All the ficus, for example, now they're not going to be happy about the low light. So you may need to augment that, which is pretty easy to do. But ficus trees are planted outside in Southern California and coastal California and can be outside even here in the valley when where we get below freezing, as long as they're in a slightly sheltered location. Ficus trees will often go through the winter, not always, but often go through the winter here in our USDA Zone 9, as long as they're in a microclimate outdoors, where they may be experiencing temperatures in the 30s. They're okay with that. So ficus is a possibility. It's just they're high light trees. So the two parts of your equation may be problematic. They can take the lower temperatures. They're okay with that. They won't be growing much when it's low temperature in there, but they'll be okay. But the low light might cause them to start yellowing and dropping leaves. It's really pretty easy nowadays to augment the light on a houseplant. So if you go with something like a ficus because of its tolerance of relatively colder conditions, augmenting the light might be important. If it were me and I'd had fun growing citrus, I'd probably get a citrus tree. Just even though you're in Michigan, I'd go ahead with a Meyer lemon or a kumquat. And I'd enjoy the way they look. And 50 degrees is fine for citrus. I mean, they can go down into the 30s without too much difficulty. They just won't have enough light in there probably to bloom or fruit real well, but they might. And kumquats and Meyer lemons in particular, especially Meyer lemons, will pop out flowers almost any time of year. You'll get the wonderful fragrance of the bloom. If you tickle it with a camel hair brush or buy a gibberellic acid spray, I'd say pollinating is probably simpler. You might even get some fruit on it. Who knows? But it could be an interesting indoor plant. So that's don't give up on Meyer lemons just because you've moved into a lower light environment. And 50 degrees, you know, that's fine for citrus. They definitely go colder than that quite regularly here in the valley. But in general, the group I would be focusing on if I lived in that situation would be the ferns and the club mosses. Ferns are generally, even the ones that we grow as houseplants, are generally tolerant of colder conditions, generally tolerant of lower light conditions. Not just Boston fern, the very well-known, you know, hanging plant that everybody likes to use, which I never sell because our climate is too hot and dry for them. You would probably do great with it. A Boston fern is certainly a good possibility. The little ferns, like the terrace ferns, P-T-E-R-I-S. The P is silent. Terrace ferns are upright growers that could be grown there. Club mosses, which if you want to look them up, you'll find under the genus Selaginella. Selaginella. They're great. They can go down into the 30s typically without much problem. There are tropical kinds, but mostly what you'll buy at stores will be subtropical or even temperate zone selaginellas, and they can grow in low light and relatively cool conditions. So you could have a really interesting room with ferns, fern-like plants, the asparagus ferns, which are not ferns at all, but can tolerate cold conditions and relatively low light. Those would all be good possibilities for you. And the indoor palm that you might consider, don't get the big one, it's a nightmare, the little Neanthobella palm, usually sold, formerly sold under the name Camaldoria elegans. It's a dwarf palm, surprisingly tolerant of low light. One of the oldest houseplants in the industry. It was a popular houseplant at the turn of the 19th century. One of the first houseplants that really caught on when the first houseplant craze happened over 100 years ago. And they're tolerant of low light conditions. In fact, that's why the Neanthobella became popular, because the first craze for houseplants was in Victorian England. And houses were dark and dingy, but they finally had indoor heating. So they could grow certain plants they'd never been able to grow before. Indoor heating was hit or miss in those places, and temperatures plummeted. Neanthobella would probably be okay. But I would focus on ferns. Fern-like plants. You could have a really cool mixed planting of club mosses and upright growing ferns. If you've got a hanger out there, a Boston fern would probably be satisfactory for you. And I think those would be some of the most adaptable plants for your situation.
So Don, you just said something that strikes a bell with me. You said here in our area, it's too dry. Mm-hmm. Well, I got to tell you, when it's snowing outside, it's cold and it is absolutely dry. We used to have to put containers of water on the heating vents in order to get the air moist enough so that our lips.
Yeah, I'm not worried about that kind of dry actually all that much. I'm worried about the entire day at 15% humidity, which is what we deal with here. We're much more desert-like conditions here, and I'd be very surprised if the humidity was that low in those conditions. However, what you're doing would be a good plan. But getting steaming some water out there wouldn't be a problem. Wouldn't be a bad idea. And my guess is that the ferns would appreciate it. So figuring out a way to increase the humidity. If you get enough plants, by the way, they'll do it. Just fill the place with plants. So if you have about a plant per 3 square feet, you'll have a very nice humid sunroom. It'll be wonderful. So the more plants you have, more to the point, to Lois's issue, if you have a bunch of plants and you're in that dry, crisp, low humidity air situation, if they're crowded together, their local environment right around the plant will be more humid. So grouping them closer together, having more plants, really important. The more plants, the better in this situation. And you might find that, you know, a little humidifier would be helpful if it really gets that dry and crackly out there. But in general, ferns, well, they don't like low humidity. They're pretty adaptable. It's the long-term high temperature, low humidity that we get here. People come into my nursery every couple months. So why don't you have any Boston ferns? I said, because they always die. Seriously, yeah. I made a policy about like 40 years ago. Houseplants that were problematic, I wouldn't sell. Because I didn't really feel like selling them a plant and then dealing with months of them coming back. I have spider mites on this. This one always gets burnt on the edges. And just having to say, yeah, that's what happens to that plant. Sorry, you know, that's just the way it goes. In our climate, Boston ferns get root bound very quickly. I mean, they're very vigorous, aggressive roots, and they're often sold in a 6-inch pot. So you're going to have to water that in our climate every single day, virtually around the calendar. And that doesn't happen at some point. So the plant burns and it looks really bad. They would need to be in a very big container. And the humidity that we get here from about May through the middle of October, by the middle of the afternoon, is very low humidity, you know, nearly every day. And so those are plants that are not happy about that. Misting them doesn't make that much difference. This is one of the popular misconceptions. Misting a plant briefly increases the humidity around it. I mean, really briefly, and not for the rest of the day. So it doesn't make much difference. Setting them on a tray of pebbles with water, it makes zero difference. I mean, that myth just needs to die and be buried. The notion that you're going to significantly increase the humidity by setting it a couple inches above some standing water in a tray just doesn't pan out. Pun intended. So I would suggest you get plants that are adapted to your climate. However, in the case of ferns, you can, as I say, crowd things together to get them to help each other. Get your plants to help each other and have a nice crowded fern and club moss gallery out there. But boy, if it were me, there'd be at least a kumquat or a Meyer lemon. I wouldn't hesitate. And I'll bet your garden center probably has one around the holidays that you can buy. I remember a question we got a couple of years ago. Someone in Massachusetts was buying a Meyer lemon for her kid. Obviously, Massachusetts, we're not growing them out in the open. So the nursery was going to sell her a little spray, a blossom set type spray with the plant. And they sent me a picture of the label. It's just gibberellic acid, which is used for the purpose of setting fruit without pollination. So it's used on any of those cuties mandarins you buy, the ones that are not naturally seedless. The way they get them seedless is they exclude the bees and they spray them with gibberellic acid to make them set fruit without pollination by bees. That's how you get the clementine without seeds. That's how you get the murcott without seeds. There are naturally seedless mandarins and there are not naturally seedless mandarins. You don't want seeds in your mandarins because you get double the price for them if they're seedless. You cover the trees completely to prevent the bees from getting to the flowers. And then you spray them with gibberellic acid to get the flowers to set fruit, and they won't have any seeds in them. Well, that's what they were selling them for their Meyer lemon, was this little spray, little tiny spray bottle. Spray the blossoms when they're open, and you'll magically get fruit even without having bees in the place. But, you know, you don't need that. A little camel's hair paintbrush. Just take it and tickle it and get some pollen on it and then tickle it again on the part that the pollen has to go to. And you've got a good lesson in biology and you also get some fruit set. So I wouldn't hesitate to try a citrus out there if you can verify that you will not get below freezing. So there are all kinds of things that I would experiment with out there. Now, the one group of plants that probably wouldn't work would be your normal orchids, but the cymbidiums would. Cymbidium orchids can tolerate cooler conditions, and they bloom mostly around Easter, but some of them bloom into the summer. So if you've got an orchid society in your area, and you probably do, see if there's anyone there with some smaller cymbidiums. Cymbidiums tend to be pretty big. I don't know how big this sunroom is, but there are some dwarf types. There's some that bloom at different seasons, and cymbidiums generally are more tolerant of cool conditions, as are, let's pretend you're going to really get into orchids now, Paphiopedilums. Sometimes called lady slipper orchids. So if you do happen to get into orchids, and you start with cymbidiums, move on to Paphiopedilums, they'll be right next to your Meyer lemon and your kumquat and all these palms and all these ferns. I want pictures when you get this all done.
Yep.
The one thing to watch for in this situation is that a pest problem can come in with the plants that you're buying and can spread rapidly from one plant to another.
And so isolate the newcomers for a little while.
Put them on
the side of the,
isolate them, inspect particularly for mealybugs, because those will spread quickly from one plant to another. They don't fly, but they do crawl from one leaf to the next. And so if your new plant comes in and is touching another plant, has a pest on it, the pest can rapidly spread. So make sure they're just not in contact with each other. And then watch for spider mites. Not likely to be a big problem in going into the winter, but as you come out of the winter and things start getting warmer in there and perhaps drier in there, spider mites can increase very, very rapidly. And so taking when it feels like spring, whenever that is in Michigan, check them closely for the beginnings of spider mites. And mostly it's the two-spot spider mite, which takes the 10-power hand lens to see, and it's on the undersides of the leaves. So just monitor for pests at the end of the winter. But be careful with any new plant you bring in, that you keep them isolated, at least no contact until you're sure they're free of mealybugs in particular. I look forward to pictures of your fern grotto.
All right. Well, Emily writes to us. She says, by the way, I love your show. Thank you, Emily. We love to hear that. Hi, Don and Lois. For flower seeds that require cold stratification, and Don will explain what that is, if I live in a low chill area, Can I fall sow them, or do I need to refrigerate them, or what? A typical winter here is the high is 60 and the low is 45 with lots of fog.
Yeah, the lots of fog and the 45 may well do what you're after. Cold stratification usually is a process where you just put the seeds, roll them in moist paper towels, or you put them in peat moss or vermiculite or seed starting mix, and you put them in the refrigerator in a closed container or plastic bag. Really easy to do. Your refrigerator is somewhere between 33 and 40 degrees. So that's the typical cold stratification period. If you're in the coastal zone, pretty good chance you'll probably get what you need. So if you got a bunch of seed, don't worry too much about it. 33 to 40 degrees is generally considered the preferred temperature for cold stratification. We do it at our nursery all the time for plant seeds when they come in. We will put them in there for 4 to 6 weeks. Doesn't matter if they're in there longer, 8 weeks is okay, whatever. But the main thing is a fairly consistent period below about 45. In fact, below 40 would be better. But my guess is because you're cool the rest of the time, you'll probably be okay. Give it a try and let us know.
And the other part of that question is, should she plant them in the fall?
A plant that needs cold stratification, if you're not going to give it the stratification in the refrigerator, go ahead and fall plant them. That'll give you your best results here in California. There may be places where that wouldn't work.
All right. Listener writes, I have a loquat tree, and parts of it, the new growth, get black and die. Is there anything to spray or do about this? What is it, Don?
What is a loquat? First of all, you know what a loquat is?
Yes, because I'm a Quaker, and at the Quaker Meeting House, we had two, one on either side of the front door, one male, one female. So the one didn't have fruit, and the other one did have fruit.
Okay, that's not
You're
true.
looking at me
They're
funny,
not
Don.
male or female.
Well, then why would one have fruit and the other not have fruit?
They're grown from seed. They're that kind of variability. Loquat flower is what we call a perfect flower. It has both the male and the female parts, and they should be self-fruitful. So for whatever reason, you had a fruitless loquat. Cool. That would be a selling point for some
Used to have
people.
it, they cut it down.
Loquats in general are, they look tropical. I mean, they're big, bold leaves. They're really cool. I grew up
Fuzzy.
My garden in San Diego that I was allowed to take over, it was like the focal tree in the backyard. And so I pruned it up and it was really lovely. It also produced massive amounts of fruit. Loquats are in the rose family. They're in the
Oh, really?
pome branch of the rose family. They're actually
Wait.
closely related to apples and pears.
Oh.
And this confuses people because they
Well, I
think,
guess that explains the structure when you cut it in half and look to the inside.
If you look closely at the fruit of a loquat and the flower, you'll realize that it's in the rose family. But the leaf doesn't look anything like other members of that
Oh.
family, particularly. It's a big tropical looking thing. Loquats are pretty cold hardy. I'll pull out my Western garden book here and see where how far into the north and higher elevations you can grow loquats. Area Batria Japonica zones 4 through 24. So sunset
Wow.
zone 4, that's pretty cold. Ours was about a 15 to 20 foot tree that my parents had purchased because they wanted one for the fruit. If you like loquats, you go and you try and find a nursery that sells cultivars of loquats. There's one called Champagne, is the one that we had, but there are others. They're just fruits that have a larger fruit to seed ratio and have a reliable tart sweet flavor. So they've been selected for the fruit. The loquat fruit looks kind of like an apple if you look closely at it. And if you cut into it, there's these giant seeds on the inside, and you take those out, and the flesh is very tangy. And like an apple, it oxidizes very quickly. So it turns brown as soon as you cut into it. So my mother would make them into chutney, which doesn't matter if it's brown. Makes a very good chutney if you happen to have loquats. They are big, bold-looking plants. They flower in the late winter, early spring. They set fruit. You're harvesting the fruit, let's see, summer. And it doesn't hold well. So it's not a fruit you're going to find in grocery stores. It spoils very quickly. But it's got a wonderful, rich flavor. Being in the pome branch of the rose family means that they are host to fire blight. So fire blight disease attacks apples, some varieties, pears, many varieties. Ornamental pears like Pyrus Kawakami. Some of the Calariana pears are very susceptible to fire blight. Hawthorns, which are in the same family, many of them are very susceptible to fire blight. Crab apples, many of them are susceptible, some are resistant. So fire blight becomes an important thing to know about if you're buying members of that branch of the rose family for your yard. No one's ever selected loquats, to my knowledge, for fire blight resistance. And I watched a neighbor around the corner here out in the country. big loquat tree about 15 feet. And one year when we had particularly bad year for fire blight, a lot of it infecting members of that group of the rose family, I saw it attack one side of the tree and the entire half of the tree died in about a 10-day period from bacterial fire blight infection. They ultimately took the tree out because it was so disfigured by it. And so this is a big problem with loquats, can be a big problem with loquats. The infection, as with apples and pears, happens through the blossom in the late winter and spring, when we have the right temperature range, 55 to 82 degrees, and a fair bit of moisture. Fire blight can spread very, very rapidly. So it's one of those things where April rains can really lead to serious infection by fire blight. And you want to prune it out if it's something like a loquat as quickly as you see it, because it can kill back a significant part of the plant in a very, very quick period. With the apples and pears, as we've discussed many times, with those, the infection goes a foot into the tree and stops. And so you can just wait out the fire blight season and get in the summer when it's too high temperature, too low humidity for fire blight, and prune out everything that was killed that spring. In the case of the loquat, that may be too late. And so in this case, she's lost a fair chunk of the tree. It actually happened several months ago, and now she's just seeing the dead part. And fire blight is a very accurate description of what the tree looks like when you get an infection. The whole branch looks like someone torched it. So it's pretty visible by summer, but you need to prune that all out of there if you possibly can. So, and her next question was, well, what do you do about it? You just prune it out. Unfortunately, there have never been really effective sprays for fire blight. Over the years, I've heard about promising research on this direction of a natural spray for them or use of copper sprays at particular times. No, none of that really works very well. You just remove it as best you can. And in general, you would avoid plants that are particularly susceptible to fire blight. If you're growing a loquat, be aware of it. It's really obvious when it hits. In that case, I would go down several inches below the point of infection, prune it out, bag that up, put it out with the trash, don't put it in nearby in your yard somewhere, and hope for the best. In a bad fire blight year, it can be really problematic, both on the fruiting loquat and on the bronze loquat, which is an ornamental non-fruiting species in the same genus that can happen to that as well. So just be aware of loquat, the fire blight, and prune it out if you possibly can as soon as you see it.
What genus or group is the flowering quince?
Shinomaly japonica is in the rose family, and it's in the apple branch of the rose family, but I've never seen fire blight on a flowering quince.
Oh, well, that's good.
Anyone out there ever seen fire blight on a flowering quince? Send us a note. Well, I guess. But in the case of the real quince, Cydonia, fire blight can be a huge problem. So quince is an actual fruit. Many of you don't know this. Quince is an actual fruit. It's like a giant rock hard apple. It's extremely aromatic. They smell wonderful, but they're even rock hard when they're ripe. So they're typically used for jam or for cooking, although I did find a recipe years ago where you slice them. Man, that's tough to do. And you layer them under a pork roast. This is apparently a Swedish recipe. And then you roast them, and that brings the flavor up into the roast and all that kind of thing and makes this kind of interesting sauce on the bottom. So quince is one of those trees that not very many people grow because you have to process them. You can't just pick them off the tree and eat them. But they're actually generally low chill. So they grow quince even in Mexico. And they're very popular down there for a particular candy and also for a wine-like liqueur. They're very easy to grow here, except for the fire blight issue. They are susceptible to fire blight, so prune that out if you see it. But the flowering quince, which is a different genus, Shinomaly japonica, as opposed to Cydonia, the Shinomaly I have not seen fire blight on. So if anyone's got that experience, let us know. Otherwise, you're probably safe, even though you're in that branch of the rose family. The other things in that branch of the rose family that you might be concerned about, pyracantha. If you have pyracanthas in your yard, look at the berry of a pyracantha. It looks like a perfect little apple. Yep, it's closely related to apples. And well, they're very popular because of the winter berries, and they're very attractive. Pyracanthas can get fire blight really badly. That's, in fact, my opinion, that's why they pretty much fell out of the nursery trade and fell out of common usage. If you really want a pyracantha, there is one that's resistant to fire blight called Santa Cruz. You can get that one. Otherwise, you're basically planting something that's going to increase fire blight locally. So let's stay away from the other varieties. But hawthorns, regrettably, the crataegus, the hawthorns, which are beautiful flowers in the spring, many of them have fruit that hangs on the tree that's very pretty, and the songbirds, I guess, like it. Most of them are very susceptible to fire blight. There's one that isn't. And so people ask me about it periodically. It's called the Washington thorn. Every now and then over the years, I've had a grower do Crataegus phainopyrum, the Washington thorn. It has 3-inch thorns all over the tree. So I planted one and I put it in a place where it would have been really showy. And the second year in, I went in to thin it out and start doing structural pruning on it. And it injured me more than once. And I thought, I don't want this tree on my property with these 3-inch needles on it. And so I took it out because it's really thorny. So those of you looking for the one fire blight resistant hawthorn, Washington thorn, Crataegus phainopyrum, good luck.
So I have an article about fruit tree chilling requirements. Mm-hmm. And this is from the Dave Wilson Nursery. It's a wonderful article.
Yeah.
And here's the summary. Number one, in fall, deciduous fruit trees lose their leaves and enter a dormant state in order to survive winter. To end dormancy, bloom, and set fruit, they require a certain amount of winter cold. That's their chilling requirement, followed by a certain amount of heat. Chilling requirements vary widely among varieties. Number two, fruit varieties with chilling requirements much lower than received at the planting location may end dormancy and bloom too early, subjecting tree, bloom, and fruit to freeze damage. Conversely, varieties with chilling requirements much higher than received will suffer delays, weak leafing and blooming, and will not set fruit satisfactorily.
Okay, so let's stop right there.
So this is really important.
Those are two very important aspects. So if you're in a place where you get spring frosts that are below 30 degrees, let's say, I mean, cold, and you have a low chill peach, there's a good chance that it will receive the chilling requirements that it needs, and you'll warm up and it'll start to bloom and you'll have a frost that'll kill the blossoms. So you don't want low chill varieties in high chill areas. That's the first thing. Flipping that around, and if you're there, hopefully the nurseries aren't selling low chill varieties. I mean, that would be pretty basic. Flipping that around, if you're in a low chill area, Southern California, coastal regions, not the interior, not so much, but the coastal areas, coastal Northern California, and you plant a variety that requires high chilling, the blooms won't open correctly. This is what happens. This is why the chilling hours matter. I have a Harcott apricot, which is a tree that a variety that we used to all sell. Sorry, those of you that bought them from me 30 years ago, I apologize. 30, 40 years ago, widely sold because it was brown rot resistant, partly because it bloomed later, but it had a pretty high chilling requirement. We get the chilling that it needs, at least in theory, but it was about 20 years ago, Harcott just gradually stopped fruiting in this area, which was weird, but true. I have one. I still have it. It's a 30 by 30 foot tree. It's a beautiful tree, so why take it out? I don't care. I don't need the spot. But if it was in your backyard, you were counting on apricots, you'd be pretty disappointed. So I was curious to watch and see what it is that exactly happens when it doesn't get the chilling that it needs. And we had one year when it set all these flower buds. It was going to be what in the apricot business they call popcorn bloom. It was going to be covered with flowers. So I went out to try and take pictures of it as they developed and opened to see if I could figure out what was going on. They don't develop and open. The buds are there. They start to push. They don't open correctly. And they just fall off, which means there's no flower. You're going to get no fruit. It made the flower buds, but the flowers didn't open correctly. If we were closer to the chilling that it needed, but not ideal, like maybe spikes of high temperature, you know, undoing some of the chilling portions as we get further in, you will get bloom over a longer period. You'll get delayed foliation. The same tree will leaf out more slowly and more erratically than normal. And the blooms will be here and there, and there'll be a bunch of them. Then there'll be more 2 to 3 week period of bloom rather than a 1 week period of bloom. That might seem like it would be okay, but from a commercial standpoint, it's kind of a disaster. Because even if they set fruit, now you're having the fruit ripening at different periods. And one of the big things orchards want is to have efficiency in their harvest operations. They don't want to have to send a harvest crew through the apricot orchard every 3 to 5 days to get the ripe ones. You want to be able to go in and harvest them mostly all at once. Even to home gardeners, it's not great because it's hard to tell when the fruit is ripe and isn't. And there's another interesting impact, which is the fruit quality is poorer. Just the whole texture of it, the fruit quality is affected by lack of correct chilling. So you really do want to get chilling hours fairly close to where you are, but people have often taken this as some kind of gospel. it says 600 hours, you only get 500. Oh, it's not going to work. No, somewhere in that range is fine. And this is particularly important for those of you listening in Southern California and places where you may only get 300, 400 chilling hours. You're looking at a variety that says it needs 500. There's a very high likelihood it will get what it needs. They're not as exact as people think. In the years I've been in business and from when I was a student, chilling hour science has evolved as a better understanding has developed of how different varieties, different groups of fruit trees are affected by chilling. We know that they grow apples in places where they shouldn't be able to grow apples based on the chilling requirements, but they are able to do so. What we know pretty much is that it's the way they go into and come out of the chilling, the way they go into and come out of dormancy that matters, not the exact number of chilling hours. And then once you dig into this, you'll see there's now like four different models for chilling hours, chilling portions, the impact of spikes of high temperature during the dormant period and so forth. So the chilling portions model has really come to dominate in the research and the information. But here's a simple thing. They don't really know exactly how the whole chilling hours process is occurring physiologically in the plant. It's obviously mediated by hormones like everything, but we don't know exactly how that's happening or why it's happening in this variety and not that variety. We just know that it does. So we just know that by observation what the chilling hours generally are that are needed for a particular variety. So use some latitude on this if you're listening in San Diego or parts of Los Angeles. This gets back to our long discussion of crab apples that we had last week. I could not find, just out of curiosity, I kept digging in, I gave up on Google a long time ago, digging into the websites of different nurseries that sell crab apples. Of course, just as the listener found, there's almost no information on the chilling hours required for crab apples, except that apparently Transcendent needs 300 to 400 chilling hours. That one's grown for the fruit. But I did find one comment. So if the crab apple person is still listening, Malus floribunda, Japanese crab apple, very popular variety, grown very widely, was described by Ellie Cook Company, no longer with us, but their website is still there, as being one of the best for warm winter areas.
Hey, well, that's good.
So that 20-minute conversation last week, in a nutshell, look for Malus floribunda wherever you are. Little susceptible to fire blight, so watch for that, prune it out. Pretty good chance that'll do what that listener was looking for, which is one that will bloom reliably in a warmer winter area and hopefully bloom at the same time as the apple trees that they were trying to cross-pollinate. Apples are probably the most complicated of this whole group. And I will just say this, if it's an apple variety that's famous in New York State, Michigan, Canada, places like that, pretty slim chance it'll do well in California, but there's a whole lot of them that do. And if it says 600 chilling hours and you're on the coast and you only get 400 or 500, pretty good chance it'll do well for you. Pretty good chance it'll go ahead and flower and fruit properly for you. So don't plant something that's way out of range. I have a pippin apple on my farm that has been here for 40 years and has never flowered or fruited. I wish it would because pippin's one of my favorites, but clearly it's not suited to this area. Pippin is said to need like 1,200 chilling hours. We get 800 here. So it just isn't happening.
Two comments. One is Don says experiment, but if I'm a home person and I've got room for two trees, I don't want to experiment. Better I should go to my local neighborhood group that is into plants and stuff and say, who's growing apples and what kind have you got and how are they doing? And you don't have to experiment on your own yard. You can learn from your neighbors.
Well, I'm going to put in a plug for the independent garden centers here because that's where the information is going to be. If you're in San Diego, go to Walter Anderson Nursery. It's the biggest nursery in the area. They sell apple trees all over, including parts of San Diego County, which are apple country. There is, as you go uphill and into interior San Diego. And that's a nursery that's almost sure to have low chill apples because they sell to the entire of San Diego County. The hardware chains, it depends on the manager. So you might get what you need, you might not. Visiting my folks later in their later years, there was a Whole Foods right near them that brought in bare root fruit trees in January. We were visiting at one point in January. There they had Bing Cherry, Red Delicious Apple. Those aren't going to fruit there. They need 800 chilling hours. There's no way within 50 miles of that store that anybody was going to get good results with those. So in my opinion, they were misleading. Well, I don't want to say they were misleading the public. They weren't saying anything. They just brought in they brought in an assortment of dormant fruit trees, which were already breaking dormancy because it was San Diego. And they're out there and I'm looking at this Blenheim Apricot, Bing Cherry, Red Delicious Apple. You know, basically the best known brand apples are what are going to be in those kind of assortments. But your big independent garden center in the Sacramento area, we have plenty of them, and not just mine, lots of other garden centers where they will have that information and where the person doing the buying has double checked to make sure they're going to be suitable to your region, we hope. But bear in mind, this is one problem. There are certain fruit varieties that are extremely popular by name, and you need to double check those. And I mentioned the best known ones like Bing Cherry. I don't recommend it. There's a lot of reasons. Red Delicious Apple, don't really recommend it. A bunch of other reasons. There are, within that selection at that garden center, if it's a well-run garden center, varieties that are more suited to your area. But another group that's really helpful is the California Rare Fruit Growers. And they have chapters all over the state. They also have a website, crfg.org, CRFG, California Rare Fruit Growers. They have chapter meetings and they have scion exchanges, and you'll get a ton of information from those. So I like to mention that group all the time because there's people there. There's probably someone in coastal Southern California who has 50 apple varieties in their backyard, all grafted on the same friggin' tree, because that's what they do. Okay. And they can tell you the ones that have done well for them.
So the last thing I want to mention, I mean, there's more to this article, which I'm not going to do, but what are chilling hours? And originally it was thought to be anything below 45 degrees.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then it been revised to it's most effective between 35 and 50 degrees. That's yep. That's a chilling hour in there. It does not occur below 30 degrees. And that's a key point because yep. In places where it freezes all winter long, mm-hmm. You're not getting chilling hours. You're just yeah. Getting frozen.
Actually, an important point. In very, very cold climates, chilling hours aren't really even discussed all that much. Mm-hmm. It's just not that big a deal. You have varieties that do well in your area and you know what they are. It's not a big problem if you're in Michigan or New York. If you're in California, Arizona, Texas, Florida, places like that, where you tend to be on the edge of that kind of winter chilling, it's more important for us.
And then the last thing that they said in here was that now with the chilling portions, the chilling hours can be negated or undone yeah. By temperatures above 60 degrees.
Really, it was the important discovery or addition to the chilling hours model. It was the understanding that above certain temperatures, it is undoing chilling hours. And that's a big issue in California and undoubtedly some of the other places I mentioned as well. Southern California interior, for example, Los Angeles can get into the 70s and 80s in January abruptly, temporarily for a few days. That's undoing chilling hours and it can have an effect on certain varieties. But what we do understand is that some are affected by higher spikes of higher temperature in the middle of winter, in particular, cherries. And to some degree, apricots. Those have been affected commercially in our area when we had a winter, when we had really warm weather. One year, it was fairly recently, just a few years ago, it was in the 70s here for 2 or 3 days in January. And the cherry crop, which is an important crop in the Stockton, Lodi, Northern California region, was off by half that year. So it had a big impact on the farmers. When I was a student, the only reason I remember all this stuff, when I was a student, it happened when I was studying pomology, that we had that winter, a winter where we only got 500 or so chilling hours. It was a warm winter. And the apricot crop, back when apricots were a big commercial crop in this area, was off by about half. Significant impact on farmers' revenues. So that's why chilling hours matter. This is really a case where new research is building on old research. So you need to find the most contemporary research on chilling hours and chilling portions that you can.
So here's our garden quote for the day. There are so many fabulous things about gardening, but the best is that anyone can do it.
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.